Locke went right home. He and Heather drove to the beach and they swam. Locke was teaching Heather to surf cast. She caught a bluefish on the second night. Heather had to train for field hockey, which would begin as soon as she went back to school, so she rose early and went running. But Locke didn't like to think of her out on the dirt roads around their house alone, the roads where Daphne had had her accident. So Locke began getting up early and going with her. He needed to lose weight anyway. He couldn't meet Claire late at night when he had to get up at 6 in the morning to go running. He couldn't meet Claire because he and Heather were surf casting, or he and Heather were renting night at the museum, or he was taking Heather to the Pearl for dinner, or Heather was at the movies with her friends, and from there was going to the juice bar for ice cream, and from there was going to hang out on the strip. When the hanging out was over, 11 o'clock, her curfew, Locke had to pick her up.
"That's perfect," Claire said. "You can stay with me until 11. Tell Daphne we're working on the seating chart."
"Right," said Locke. "But Heather might need me before 11 if she wants to go home early."
"You're kidding me, right?" Claire said. He had expected her to be more understanding. She had 4 children. She was a slave to their schedules as much as he was to Heather's.
"I have to be available for her," Locke said.
He was terrified that Heather would get bored and take off, that she would find fault with him or with Daphne and leave. Claire's kids were younger. They were not at the point yet where they could use their own wings.
"But just wait until they do," Locke said. "It will throw you for a loop. You will understand then where I'm coming from."
Claire said, "I feel like I've been replaced."
"I feel funny doing this when Heather's on the island," he said. "She's always been away, at school, or on the vineyard. Now that she's here, I feel worse about it somehow, like I'm betraying her."
Claire narrowed her eyes.
"How dare you say that?"
"What?"
"I have children, too. I have 4 sweet, adorable children at home, but I don't throw them down in your path to make you feel guilty, do I? I leave the kids out of it. Heather isn't any different because she's yours. She's not better or more special than my children."
"I wasn't saying she was."
"You were so. You said you felt like you were betraying her. All of the kids are getting betrayed, Locke. I've had to live with it since last fall."
He kissed her head.
"You're right. I'm sorry."
She pulled away.
"You are so hurtful. You are so arrogant. God, it infuriates me."
He was tempted to let her go. Even a few weeks ago, this would have been unthinkable. He needed Claire. His happiness depended on her. But Heather was his daughter, his only child. Did he have to keep explaining it?
"I'm afraid she's going to leave," he said. "I have to do everything humanly possible to keep her here."
Claire pinched the bridge of her nose.
"I'm going," she said.
Locke checked his watch.
"Okay," he said.
Claire flew down the stairs.
"I love you,"
he called out. She slammed the door. He saw her again a few days later, and he apologized. They were both under a lot of stress, he said. Once the gala was over, things would get back to normal.
"What exactly is normal?" Claire said.
He laughed, but she did not find it funny. He changed the subject.
"I saw you bought your table for the concert."
"Matthew paid for it."
"Matthew?"
"Max West. He sent me a check."
"You're kidding me."
"I didn't have the money, not even close."
"You said you had money set aside."
"I lied."
"Jesus, Claire, if you needed money, you could have asked me."
"What?"
"You could have asked me. I would have happily bought your table."
"And what exactly would you have told Daphne?"
"She wouldn't have noticed."
"She wouldn't have noticed?"
"It all goes through our accountant," Locke said. "I wish you had asked me, instead of hitting up your old rock star boyfriend."
"Did you actually just utter that sentence?" Claire said.
"What?"
Locke said.
"I would have liked to come to your rescue. I wish you'd asked me instead of Max."
"You're picking a fight with me."
"I'm confused. Why did you feel you had to lie to Isabel?
Isn't it obvious?
No, it isn't. There was no pressure for you to take a $25,000 table.
Yes, there was.
You imagined there was.
Don't be an ass, Locke. There was pressure.
We have to lead by example. I am leading by example. We have to sit up front together.
She was doing a fair imitation of Isabel's voice, and Locke smiled.
Don't laugh. It's not funny. I was bullied into it.
Well, you didn't end up paying. You should be happy.
Happy, she said.
She was angry now. Her lips were pale and bloodless, and her cheeks were blazing.
He needed to let this subject go. Was he affronted that she hadn't asked him for money? Yes, he was, a little bit. He grabbed her.
I want to be the person who fixes your problems. I want you to turn to me.
But I can't, Claire said. I love you madly and badly, but I can't depend on you for anything because you're not mine. And you'll never be mine, will you?
That was the question. The affair had seemed so right when it started. It had been the answer to his prayers. But with each passing day, it got more complicated. He felt himself sinking, and he wanted to sink. He wanted to become utterly consumed with Claire. But he couldn't take the final step and leave Daphne. He was certainly not willing to do it with Heather at home.
I'm giving you everything I have, he said.
You're giving me everything you have, Claire said. But it's not enough.
It's not, he said.
The next day, Benjamin Franklin, treasurer of the Nantucket's Children Board of Directors, walked into the office and asked Locke to see the financial records since the audit. Locke glanced at Gavin's desk. Gavin was out for the afternoon. His parents were arriving on the island that evening, and Gavin needed time to spruce the house up, get his father's Cherokee serviced, buy flowers and wine for his mother, etc., etc. Gavin would know where the financials were. He would be able to explain it all to Ben Franklin. Wouldn't you just know that Ben Franklin would come while Gavin was out? Frustrating.
Why do you want to see them, Ben?
Locke asked. This was, after all, an unusual request. Ben Franklin was reluctant at best about being treasurer, lazy at worst. He liked Gavin to do all the work for him, and Ben wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer anymore. Locke studied him. Did he even know what he was asking? Ben chuckled.
My granddaughter, Eliza, works at the bank as a summer teller.
And?
And I'd like to look the books over to see what it is you're trying to hide.
Hide? Locke said. Gavin keeps the most impeccable books you've ever seen.
He stood up, and Ben trailed him to Gavin's desk. Locke opened the filing cabinet. Financials 2007 to 2008. A manila folder with the bank statements. He pulled it and handed it to Ben.
And I need the donor log, Ben said, and a copy of the most recent budget.
Yep,
Locke said, trying not to sound impatient. One of Ben's 20 million grandchildren worked at the bank as a summer teller, and for this reason Ben wanted to see the financials. It was a complete non sequitur. Locke logged on to Gavin's computer, pulled up the files, and printed them out. Ben Franklin and Locke were silent as the pages printed. Locke was preoccupied with thinking who on the current board might replace Ben as treasurer. It was a thankless job. Nobody wanted to do it. Locke handed the sheets to Ben.
There you go, sir. I'm sure you'll find them all in order.
Ben tipped an imaginary hat.
I'm sure I will.
They made a pact. No more fighting. Things had become tense between them.
I feel like you're squeezing me in, Claire said.
It's felt that way to me since we started, Locke said. I always have to accommodate your schedule, and you're a frightfully busy woman. Now I'm busier because of Heather. I squeeze you in, you squeeze me in. We squeeze each other in. Nothing in this relationship is as one-sided as you think it is, Claire.
No, she said. She was dying to challenge him. Just seeing his name on the display of her cell phone made her feel combative. It wasn't right. So they called a truce. They shook hands. Just get through the next 3 weeks past the gala, get Heather back to Andover, the kids back in school, start over. Agreed? Agreed. The work for the gala was almost done. It was time to enjoy it, Locke said. After all, it was a party. A party? Yes, he was right. The GD chandelier was completed. Ted Trimble had it now, and he was, very carefully, wiring it. Claire had 8 spaces at her table to fill. Since Matthew had paid for the table, Claire was able to give seats away. She invited Siobhan and Carter first, and surprise, Siobhan was thrilled. Claire invited Adams and Heidi Fisk, and Christo and Delaney Kitt. She invited Ted and Amy Trimble as a thank you for wiring the chandelier. Already, Claire was feeling better. She was feeling excited. She would be up front, surrounded by her dearest friends. This was her event. Max West would play, and Pietro da Silva would auction off the first piece she had created in nearly 2 years. She was the co-chair. This was her party, thrown in a tent as big as an airplane hangar. Woohoo! She needed a dress. She took a full morning off with Siobhan, and together the two of them hit the town. It was impossible to buy certain things on Nantucket. A set of blue plain cotton sheets, for example, or gym socks, children's underwear, a plastic colander, a softball, anything in bulk. But if you were looking for a party dress, Nantucket was utopia. Claire and Siobhan shopped at Hepburn, Vis-a-Vis, David Chase, Eye of the Needle, Erica Wilson. So many sensational dresses. Siobhan wanted something black, something dramatic, something that would stand in contrast to her chef's jacket. She found a knockout dress at Erica Wilson, a halter dress with a fitted skirt and beading, absolutely gorgeous. But everything looked good on Siobhan. She had healthy coloring and a tiny little body. Claire was harder to outfit. She tried on everything. Some things looked truly hideous, clashing with her red hair, making her look like a cadaver. She found a few things she liked, nothing she loved. They ate lunch on the patio at the Rope Walk. Lobster rolls, fried clams. Claire felt like a tourist, which was nice, if odd. They were drinking wine to boot. Claire a glass of Viognier, she ordered it automatically now, and Siobhan a fat glass of Chardonnay. Siobhan raised her glass. This is fun, she said. This is what I miss.
Me too, Claire said.
No, Siobhan said. I mean it.
She covered Claire's hand with her own smaller hand. Claire knew Siobhan's hand intimately, its elfin size, the nails bitten to the quick, the simple wedding band in white gold.
When all this is over, do I get you back?
Don't be silly, Claire said. You have me now.
Siobhan pushed her darling square prescription sunglasses up her nose.
Do I get you back, Claire?
Claire sipped her wine. Her stomach squelched at the smell of fried food in the air. Here, on their carefree day of shopping, Siobhan was asking for something. She wanted Claire back with Jason, ensconced in the Crispin clan, fitted snugly in her place.
Do I get you back?
Meaning, no more Locke. Their onion rings arrived at that second, and then a woman from the next table asked if Siobhan would take a picture of her and her family. Claire leaned back in her wrought iron chair and looked out at the brilliant blue harbor, the circling seagulls, the white snap of sails, the wispy clouds. The day sparkled.
This is fun. This is what I miss. Do I get you back, Claire? Do I get you back?
Claire sipped her Viognier and enjoyed the sun on her face, despite the inevitability of freckles. The family said, in chorus,
Cheese!
The question floated away, without an answer. 11 days to go. Claire woke up suspicious. Something wasn't right. She rolled over. Jason was gone. He was at the Downy Flake. Through a fog of sleep, she'd heard him get up, dress, leave. Out in the kitchen, she found her cell phone and called him. It was considered a major foul to interrupt Jason at breakfast, but she had a persistent, nagging worry that something was amiss. She pictured him in a crowded airport, fed up, leaving. Had he left?
Hey,
Jason said, uninspired, impatient. But this she expected. He was marking off the days on the family calendar until the gala. This past Sunday, reclining in his chair at the beach, he'd muttered under his breath when Claire thought he was asleep.
In 2 weeks, the goddamn thing will be over.
Is everything okay?
Everything's fine.
You're at the Downy Flake?
Of course, he said. Where else would I be?
Claire made the kids breakfast. She was preoccupied, but she could do it in her sleep. Should she call Siobhan and check on her? No, she was losing her mind. She was looking for something to go wrong. JD said, Mom! Claire looked up, alarmed. What? I want to go to Nobadir. Pan keeps taking us to Eel Point, and it's a baby beach. Think of Shay, Claire said, and Zachy.
I want waves, JD said. I haven't used my boogie board once all summer.
Well, I'm sorry, Claire said.
You don't care about me.
That's not true.
You only care about Zach.
JD, you know that's not true. It hurts me when you say that.
It hurts me that I can't go to Nobadir.
I can't let Pan take you there. Zach would drown in 10 seconds. And even worse is your sister. She'll be out in those waves trying to keep up with you and... Claire shuddered. I can't even stand to think about it.
You take me then.
I'm sorry?
Why can't you take me?
The obvious answer was that she was busy. She had been doing another set of vases for Transom, for income, to appease Jason. And out of the blue, Mr. Fred Bullrush of San Francisco had called.
I heard you were back at it.
How had he heard? Claire had no idea. She had yet to call him back, but it would be nice to get a commission and see some real money. Claire was supposed to meet Isabel at noon to go over the seating chart, though really this was fruitless. Isabel would seat people where she wanted, no matter what Claire said. So why not spend the afternoon at Nobadir with JD? She loved spending time with the kids one-on-one, though she rarely got the chance. Why not take advantage today? Get sandwiches and sodas at Henry's and take her oldest son to the waves. She could read the new Margaret Atwood novel while JD wrote his boogie board. Okay, she said. I'll take you.
I want to go,
Ottilie said.
Me too,
said Shay. No, Claire said. This is just an outing for JD. You two are going with Pan. I'll pack extra Oreos. Ottilie scowled. Shay was appeased by the cookies. Claire's phone rang. It was Locke, calling at 8:05. Fear gripped Claire's knees. Here it was, the bad news. Hello, Claire said.
I have bad news, Locke said.
Claire killed the burner under the bacon. What is it?
Genevieve can't do it.
Can't do what?
The gala.
She can't cater the gala? 10 days and counting, and she can't...
That's right. Something about her mother in Arizona. She's sick, terminal, I guess. Genevieve has to get there now, today. She doesn't know when she'll be back. She can't prep an event for 1,000 people, and she has no second. No one to take over. We have to find someone else.
Like who?
Well, I thought you might call Siobhan.
Siobhan? Claire said.
Yes, that's the obvious answer, right?
Right, Claire said. But was it? The catering question had been painful from the beginning. It had caused a rift in Claire and Siobhan's unriftable friendship, and only now had things settled. Only now did Siobhan seem comfortable with the outcome. To reopen discussions of Siobhan and Carter's catering was unfair. But if Genevieve couldn't do it, someone had to step in. And if Claire overlooked Siobhan as that person, if Siobhan wasn't asked first, there would be a fresh hell to face.
Okay, Claire said. I'll call.
She hung up the phone and looked at J.D. Get your suit on. J.D. breathed a sigh of relief.
Thank God, he said. I thought you were going to bag on me.
Bag on you, she said.
Never.
She picked up Zach, washed the syrup off his face and hands, and carried him into her bedroom, where she dialed Siobhan.
Hey,
Siobhan said.
Hey, Claire said. You know, I woke up with a funny feeling that something awful was going to happen, and it has.
Are the kids okay?
Siobhan said. Everyone's fine. It's a different kind of awful.
Tell me.
Genevieve flaked.
Huh?
She canceled. Her mother is sick in Arizona. She has to go. She bagged the gala.
Silence.
Then laughter. Siobhan was chuckling musically. There were two ways in which this was not funny. It was not funny that Genevieve's mother was dying. Claire had lost her mother to cancer, and so had Siobhan. And it was not funny that the gala had no caterer.
I hate to ask you this, but...
Oh, no,
Siobhan said.
No way.
You won't do it?
Are you kidding me?
Siobhan said.
I have seats right up front and a kick-ass dress. Why the hell would I trade that in so I can spend the next 10 days slaving and sweating and swearing? Bad enough I have the pops to do on Saturday. I have no desire to turn around on Sunday and start prepping for another monster job.
It's a lot of money, though, Siobhan.
I am happy to say I don't care.
So you won't do it?
Don't sound so shocked.
I'm not shocked, but I thought you wanted this job.
No,
Siobhan said.
After all the crap I've been through. I mean, I realize I'm on the committee, and that means I should be there in the final hour to bail you guys out. But Edward had a chance to hire me, and he passed. He chose Genevieve. The fact that Genevieve flaked is utterly predictable. I find it gratifying that she flaked, because that means I was not bad-mouthing her back in April, but rather speaking the truth about her. She's unprofessional, and she should never have been given the job. When someone comes $40 a head under, there's a reason.
Okay, well, if you're not going to do it, who else should I call? I have to get someone today.
Claire's phone beeped. The display said, Isabel French.
Oh, shit. Isabel's on the other line. I'll call her back. Who else should I ask?
To feed 1,000 people in 10 days?
Siobhan said.
Nobody I know. It's August, Claire. People are booked and overbooked. If someone is free, there's a reason, and you shouldn't hire them.
Great, Claire said. So you're telling me the only people I want are people who aren't available?
Pretty much.
Isabel's number beeped in again. Claire should switch over, but she wasn't ready for that brand of hysteria.
Okay, Claire said.
She knew she should be panicked. They had no caterer for the gala, no food, no drink. But Claire felt calm. She had woken up with a bad feeling, and here it was, realized. J.D. walked into the bedroom in his bathing suit with a towel around his neck. Should she bag on him, and instead spend all day in the office with Isabel, dialing every caterer in the phone book? Was this the right thing to do? The right choice was usually the more difficult one. Who had told her that? Father Dominic? Her mother? But putting the gala before her family and disappointing her son could not be the right choice here. So in this rare case, the right choice was the less difficult one.
Listen, I'm taking J.D. to Nobadir, just the two of us. Want to meet me there with the boys?
I am up to my tits in pops,
Siobhan said.
But... what the hell? I'll come for an hour.
The hours Claire spent at the beach were like hours spent dreaming. The sun was hot, the water refreshing, and J.D. was happy and exhilarated by the waves and by his cousins. Siobhan came for an hour and brought Claire half a chicken salad sandwich, a cup of gazpacho, and a bottle of fancy Italian lemonade. Claire's phone rang off the hook. Isabel, Locke, Edward, Genevieve. But Claire didn't take a single call. She would deal with the catering problem later, and quite possibly,
By the time she gave it her full attention, it would be solved. It was liberating to let it go. It was fortifying to spend 4 hours being herself, a woman who loved the beach, the mother of a 10-year-old boy. She even tried to boogie board a few times. It was too hot to stay out of the water. She rode the waves to shore, enjoying the swell and the rush, enjoying even the sand in her suit and the salt stinging her eyes. They left the beach at 4:45, in time to get home and relieve Pan. Claire was so relaxed that she let J.D. sit in the front seat next to her. His dark blonde hair was damp, his bare torso suntanned and rippling with emerging muscles. He, like Jason, would be handsome and strong. J.D. switched the radio station 15 times, to finally be in control of the music, and he polished off his Coke, then casually hung his elbow out the open window. As they turned the corner onto their street, J.D. said, "Mom, that was awesome. You rock." Claire grinned. Her face was tight and warm from the sun. 10, she decided, was the perfect age for a boy. J.D. did not need the constant caretaking that the other kids needed, but his heart and mind were still those of a child. "You were great company," she said. There was an unfamiliar car in their driveway. As Claire pulled in, her good mood evaporated. It was not an unfamiliar car at all. It was a green Jaguar convertible, the car Locke drove in the summertime. Locke was not a man who got excited about cars. As the director of Nantucket's children, he always said, he should be driving a 12-year-old minivan, but this car he loved. The XKR was sleek, curvy, and fast, in a prestigious racing green. He would not park it on the street. It spent all summer in the yacht club parking lot. Now, here it was in Claire's driveway. Locke sat in one of the Adirondack chairs next to Claire's mudroom door. He was wearing a khaki suit, a pink seersucker shirt, a darker pink tie, and loafers without socks. A hanging geranium twirled above his head. A few pink petals had dropped onto the creamy shoulders of his jacket. How long had he been sitting there? He was pitched forward, his forearms on his knees, staring expectantly out at Claire's cul-de-sac. Willing her to appear? Well, yes, obviously. Claire had never known Locke to idly wait anywhere for anything. The man was a model of efficiency, always on the phone, or reviewing paperwork, or drafting letters, or reading relevant articles in philanthropic magazines or The Economist or Barron's. It was almost like this wasn't really him. "Who's that guy?" J.D. asked. Claire was frozen. She could barely twist her wrist to remove the key from the ignition. She was stunned by Locke's presence. He had stopped by unannounced only one other time, and that was back in January, when he had entered her hot shop while she was working. Back then, she had been surprised, yes, certainly. But back then, a part of her had been expecting him. Back then, he was always on her mind. Thoughts of him followed her everywhere, so the fact that he had appeared out of the blue seemed right. That day had marked the first time Locke had told her he loved her. It had been magic, his appearing to declare that. It had been supernatural. But now, today, Claire was tense, on guard. She was a little repulsed. Part of this was because she looked awful. As she got out of the car, this came into clearer focus. The fronts of her legs were sunburned. She was wearing a damp cotton beach cover-up that had at one time been white but was now the color of old chewing gum, and her hair was like a clump of seaweed, tangled and salty. Her feet were sandy, and she could feel freckles popping out all over her face. She did not want Locke to see her this way, looking like something that had washed up on the beach. Nor did she want to see Locke in all his seasonal pink, sockless, his thinning hair windblown from a ride in his convertible. She had done a thorough job of blocking him out of her mind and had successfully forgotten all about the catering nonsense, but now she would have to deal with it. This wasn't what petrified Claire, however. What petrified Claire was the notion that Locke had not come on official gala fix the catering nonsense, but had come finally to whisk Claire away. The Jaguar was the white horse.
Locke had been watching for her so eagerly and stood so suddenly when she emerged from the car that Claire thought, oh God, he's going to do it. Ask me to run away with him. He wanted her to climb into the Jag and drive off with a wave, leaving J.D. baffled on the porch. Claire opened the back of the Pilot, pulled out the sandy towels, and took her time shaking them. She slid out the boogie boards, handed them to J.D. and said, would you rinse these, please, sweetheart? J.D. was looking at Locke. Locke was looking at Claire. J.D. took the boogie boards to the hose on the side of the house. Claire trudged up the porch stairs in her dime store flip-flops. He would never ask her to go with him, she realized. And suddenly that was all she wanted, for him to ask, for him to beg. Hi, she said.
Hi,
he said. She wondered about her other children and Pan. They weren't home yet. The inside of the house was too quiet. Claire busied herself with folding the damp towels. You've taken me by surprise, she said, moving to the mudroom door.
I was on my way home from work,
Locke said. He smiled tightly.
I've been trying to reach you all day. We have to talk.
She turned to him. She couldn't breathe. Really? If he asked her? If he meant it? If he promised her all the right things? If he'd thought it through very carefully and still made it romantic and spontaneous, the chance of a lifetime? The chance for happiness with a man who understood her better, differently, would she go with him?
No, never.
But she might.
About the catering, he said.
As they entered the house, Claire wondered, was it a mess? In her mind, the house was always a mess, with the flotsam of their lives littering every surface, bills, mail, magazines, the girls' ponytail holders, Zach's pacifiers and bottles with half an inch of sour milk left, sunglasses, keys, the nails and screws and spare change that Jason emptied from his pockets each evening. Yes, it was all there, the family's life exposed. Someone's used Band-Aid was on the counter, and Claire swept it into the trash. Claire had never been to Locke's house, but she gathered it was one of those homes where everything was tucked away so that the place was left with as much personality as a hotel room. Claire's answering machine was blinking. 8 messages. Claire opened the fridge. Would you like some cold grapes?
You don't have to entertain me,
Locke said. Claire pulled out the colander of grapes anyway and set it on the bar. How about a beer? Locke shrugged.
After the day I had, sure.
Okay, so he was going to talk about his day. One hell of a day he had, while Claire was at the beach, boogie boarding and drinking sparkling Italian lemonade. J.D. marched in, and Claire said, outdoor shower, please.
I'm going.
Locke offered his hand.
Hey, you must be J.D. I'm Locke Dixon.
J.D. shook his hand, looked him in the eye, smiled. Nice to meet you, Mr. Dixon.
I'm a friend of your mother's.
We work together, Claire said. We're working on the gala together. Mr. Dixon runs Nantucket's Children.
Okay,
J.D. said. He disappeared out the back door.
He has nice manners,
Locke said. Claire pulled one of Jason's beers out of the fridge and flipped off the top. Glass?
No, thanks.
He was here, in the house. He had met and approved of the oldest child. He was drinking Jason's beer, and Claire was supremely uncomfortable with all of it. Give me the lowdown, she said. He removed his jacket and hung it on the back of the bar stool. He rolled up the sleeves of his seersucker shirt neatly. Here was Locke Dixon relaxing with a beer after work. Claire watched him. He was her lover, but he was a complete stranger. Claire heard stampeding feet in the mudroom. The rest of the gang traipsed in, Zach crying, Pan looking beat up and weary. The girls, like J.D., stopped what they were doing, bickering, dropped their sodden towels on the floor, and stared at Locke.
Who's that? Shay demanded.
This is Mr. Dixon, Claire said, Mommy's helper on the gala. Locke waved at Pan.
Nice to see you again.
Pan smiled.
and handed Zack off to Claire. He was hot and unhappy, and his diaper was leaking and full of sand. Claire wasn't sure what to do. This wasn't exactly how she wanted Locke to see her life.
"Is that your car?" Audley asked.
"It is," Locke said.
"I like it," she said.
"I have to talk to your mom right now," Locke said. "But next time I come, I'll give you a ride."
"Can I ride too?" Shay asked.
There was a knock at the door. The front door, which meant UPS or a neighbor's child selling raffle tickets.
"Okay,"
Claire said to the kids. "To the shower, please." She was using her Julie Andrews voice. "They're only young once, must enjoy them." She wanted Locke to see that she was a good mother, the best mother, despite her obvious shortcoming.
"Excuse me one second," she said, and she went to the door.
There was another knock before Claire could reach the door, crisp, insistent. Claire peeked out the window, another car in the driveway, a cherry red Land Rover with roux bars. So not the Girl Scouts. The first thing Claire saw when she opened the door was the hair, long and lustrous.
"Isabel," Claire said.
Now she was officially aghast. Zack's diaper was so heavy it was falling off. Claire could hear the girls pounding on the door of the outdoor shower to get JD out.
"Hello,"
Isabel said, with a mixture of surprise and distaste, as though it were Claire who had ambushed her at home, and not the other way around. She stepped inside.
"Is Locke here?"
"Yes," Claire said. She looked down at her cover-up, her legs, her feet. Isabel was looking very tan and lithe in a white eyelet sundress, and Claire was wearing a trash bag with four hot, sandy, hungry children running around like wild Indians. When she had woken up this morning and felt like something bad was going to happen, she could never have predicted that it would be something this specifically bad. But as Isabel walked past her into the great room without so much as a word of apology, or for that matter, greeting, Claire got a hold of herself. Locke and Isabel had shown up without warning and had plopped themselves down in her home. She would not allow herself to feel self-conscious about how she looked, or about the fact that there was no babbling koi pond at the entryway, or that she didn't have a pitcher of gin and tonics and hors d'oeuvres ready. She would deal with these people graciously, then send them off. First, however, she had to deal with the Indians.
"I have to change a diaper," she said.
"Locke, will you pour a glass of wine for Isabel, please? There's a bottle of cold Viognier in the fridge."
This was, incredibly, true, and Claire was secretly thrilled.
She took Zack upstairs, rinsed him off in the sink, changed his diaper, and dressed him in an adorable blue terry cloth playsuit. When she came back down, Locke and Isabel were seated at the bar with their drinks, popping cold grapes, while the three kids stood wrapped in towels, dripping onto the floor and looking like refugee boat people.
"Go get dressed," Claire said, "and I'll let you watch a little TV before dinner."
"What's for
steaks," Claire said, "and corn." The children slinked off, casting furtive looks at the strangers in the kitchen. As soon as the kids were gone, Isabel got down to business.
"We have a serious problem," she said.
Out the mudroom window, Claire saw Jason's truck pull into the driveway. She felt a wash of relief.
"We'll find another caterer," Claire said.
"I've called everyone on Nantucket. I spent all day on the phone, and so did Gavin, and so did Locke. No one is available. I called all the restaurants. I even called the head of the high school cafeteria."
"I find that hard to believe," Claire said.
"Someone said the woman did private catering on the side. I called 14 places on the Cape, all the way down to Wareham, and nobody can do it. The party is too big. They don't have the staff. It's too expensive to get here. We don't have a prep kitchen." "It's not looking good," Locke said. "To bring someone in from New York, which is what we may have to do, will be prohibitively expensive. And again, the problem of the prep kitchen." He took a swill of beer.
Claire needed a drink herself, but Locke had not poured her one. Claire pointedly poured herself a glass of wine. She looked at Locke and Isabel, sitting side by side in their perfect summer clothes, like two people who had escaped from a Renoir painting. They were a natural pair. Claire could see this suddenly, clearly, without feeling one way or the other about it.
They should be together.
Isabel was unmarried, or nearly so. The two of them were much better suited for each other than Claire and Locke. She wasn't able to follow this train of thought, however, because at that moment, Locke dropped the bomb.
We need you to try one more time with Siobhan.
The we bugged her royally. We, meaning Locke and Isabel, meaning the people who had slaved over the problem while Claire was at the beach, meaning Nantucket's children. It didn't matter. I did, Claire said. She said no.
We need you to try again. We need you to beg. No food, no drink, or food and drink that is so expensive. We don't make one red cent on this gig. After all the work we've done, you get it? We're up against the wall, desperate.
Desperate, Claire repeated. She looked at Isabel, who had her head bowed and folded hands in a posture of prayer. It fell to Claire and Claire alone. Again? Would it never end? The mudroom door slammed. Jason stepped into the kitchen. He looked at Isabel, then Locke, then Isabel again. Claire felt a sting of jealousy, but how could Jason keep from staring at Isabel when she had all that beautiful long hair and the even tan and the thin gold bracelet at her wrist and the perfectly shaped nails polished to look like glass? She was the most put-together woman who had ever graced their house. That Jaguar yours? Jason said.
The Rover is mine, she said.
Jason, this is Isabel French, my co-chair for the gala. Isabel, my husband, Jason Crispin.
Pleasure, she said, and they clasped hands. Jason?
Locke said, standing. Jason and Locke shook hands. The Jag is yours? Jason said.
It is.
Sweet. Jason eyed their drinks. Can I get you another? Locke, another beer? Isabel, more wine? Jason was suddenly the consummate host. Claire said, We're having a meeting. The caterer for the gala, Genevieve, can't do it. Her mother is very sick. We have no caterer. You should ask my brother, Jason said to Locke. And Siobhan, they'll do it. I did ask them, Claire said. They said no. Ask again, Jason said, popping a beer, or I'll ask.
That would be great, Isabel said. It would honestly be so great if you would ask again. We're up against the wall.
No problem. Jason clapped Locke on the shoulder. Are you two staying for dinner? Claire, what's for dinner? Was this really happening? Claire couldn't be sure. Maybe she was still asleep in her chair on the beach. Steaks, she said, and corn. She raised her eyebrows at Locke. If she wasn't careful, she was going to say something grossly inappropriate. You're welcome to stay if you'd like.
No thanks, Locke said. I have a dinner at the yacht club.
Oh, funny, Isabel said.
So do I.
Funny? When Claire smiled, her teeth were cold. Her face was stiff from the sun and the salt. She wanted Locke and Isabel out of her house. They could go on to the yacht club for dinner. That was fine. Claire wanted to sit with her kids on the back deck and shuck the corn. And while the corn was boiling and the steak grilling, she wanted to take a long, hot outdoor shower. Jason could call Carter and Siobhan and ask about the catering yet again at Isabel's behest, but they would say no, and Claire would be able to end her day with a fat, satisfying, I told you so. Claire smiled at Isabel and Locke a little more broadly. They weren't finished with their drinks, but she didn't care. I'll walk you out, Claire said. Isabel downed her wine in one gulp.
Everything is going to work out, she said. I can feel it.
She slid off her stool, and at the door she linked her arm through Locke's. Locke glanced at Claire. Claire could not look at him.
I'm sorry we just barged in on you, Locke said. I tried calling.
I know, Claire said. I was avoiding my calls.
We're in a legitimate bind,
he said. I realize that, Claire said.
We both found your little disappearing act today discouraging and immature, Isabel said.
You were at the beach.
You should have been helping us. You are the co-chair.
She couldn't wait for them to leave. Get in the car, she thought. Please leave. Did you? She said.
Well, I'm sorry.
You don't sound sorry.
I took my son to the beach. I had a nice day. Locke cleared his throat. He looked like he wanted to shrug Isabel's arm off, but he was too polite.
The gala is in...
I'm well aware of when the gala is, Locke. He sighed and searched her face for what? Love? Tenderness? A sign that she was contrite for not sitting on the phone all day dialing caterers? At that second, she thought, run away with Isabel since she's so devoted to the cause. Locke and Isabel found her immature and discouraging. What was discouraging was that they had dumped the catering disaster in her lap, and now she would have to own it. They made their way down the porch steps, Isabel's arm wrapped through Locke's like a snake. Isabel trailed Locke to his car, and after he got in, she stood at the driver's side talking to him sotto voce. Talking to him about Claire. Jason was in the kitchen. Claire, he said. Claire wanted Jason next to her at the front door. He was the other half of her united front, the happy Crispins. Claire, he called. What? She said. If he wanted dinner, he could start by lighting the grill. Look at this. She turned to see Jason crouching down, holding Zack by both hands, but then he let go, and Zack took 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps, bumped into the cabinet that held the pots and pans, and fell onto his butt. Claire shrieked, "He walked!" Zack grinned at his parents, then started crying. He walked, she said. He walked, Jason said. He's a walker. He grabbed Claire's hand and pulled her in tight, kissed her throat. She hugged him, and suddenly she was so, so happy, happier than she'd been in a long time. He's a walker, she said, and she hoped that this was all she would remember about today. The morning after Claire had offered Siobhan the gala catering job and Siobhan turned it down, once and for all, she hoped that was clear, Siobhan was awakened by a voice in her walk-in closet. She looked at the clock. 6:10. Fucking absurd. Siobhan climbed out of bed, naked as a jaybird, and stood in front of the closet door to make sure. Yes, Carter was in there, on the phone. Growing up, Siobhan and her siblings had pulled blankets over their heads, spoken in pig Latin, stretched the cord of the phone all the way to the stairs of the root cellar, then slammed the door for privacy, gossiping about Michael O'Keefe at first, and then, in later years, about where they hid the beer. They didn't do it to save their father's ears. Siobhan did not knock, though with the boys always underfoot, knocking before entering a room was law, because the closet was not a proper room. Siobhan flung open the door, and there was Carter, sitting on her velvet footstool, the newspaper in his lap. On the phone with Tomas, his bookie in Las Vegas, where it was 3 a.m, betting on the bloody Red Sox. What Siobhan heard Carter say was, "Put down 5,000 even. Schilling is pitching." How to describe the scene that ensued? It was cinematic. It was Shakespearean. Siobhan snatched the phone from Carter's hand and ran like a jackrabbit into the master bath. She eyed the oval pool of the toilet, and her gag reflex kicked in. She was going to be sick. She heard Carter coming. There wasn't time. She flushed the phone down the toilet. "What the hell?" Carter said. Siobhan canceled their credit card. "Stolen," she said. When she hung up, Carter was staring her down. $5,000. She fired Carter right there and then. Fired Carter from the business that they owned together, the business in which he was the head chef. Siobhan had no idea if she had the legal right to do this, but she could not have been more fucking emphatic. "You are no longer part of Island Fair. Do not prep any more jobs. Do not set foot in the kitchen. You are throwing every red cent we have earned into some stinking Vegas cesspool." Carter tried several tacks. He apologized with the desperate mien of a druggie begging his dealer for one last score. He cried, "Please, baby, please, one more game. It's a sure thing, I promise. Schilling is pitching, baby." Siobhan was so livid she could not speak. She stormed into the kitchen for coffee, and Carter followed, crying. She poured coffee, but she missed her cup. It spilled all over the counter and dripped onto the floor, and this sent Siobhan over the edge. In the most venomous whisper she could summon, she said,
"You're trying to ruin us."
"No, baby, I'm not.
Have you no shame?"
she asked. Because really, they had a mortgage. And besides that, two little boys upstairs who would, unlike Siobhan or Carter, go to college someday. Carter was confused by the question.
"Shame?"
Siobhan said,
"Look at you. Pathetic."
At this, he became belligerent. "You can't tell me what to do. You can't fire me from my own business," and stormed out, though not before stopping in the garage to collect his surfboard. Siobhan called Claire. If this had happened last August, Siobhan would have regaled her with all the gory details. But now, of course, things had changed. She and Claire were operating on a need-to-know basis, and all Claire needed to know was that, yes, Island Fair would cater the gala. They were eager to do it. Claire yippied and made some other yee-haw cowboy noises. "Yesterday was so bad," Claire said, "but then Zach walked, he took his first steps, and now you're going to cater the gala, just like the two of us planned in the beginning. It feels so right. It's all coming full circle. Hooray!" Claire was eager then to get off the phone. She couldn't wait to call Isabel and Locke and tell them the happy news. Claire did not think, would never under current circumstances have thought, to ask, why the sudden change of heart? Why, when Siobhan had been so adamant the evening before, was she so eager now? Had something happened? Claire didn't ask, and really, it was just as well. Siobhan didn't need a lot of caretaking. She was a hard-scrabble girl, tough as a turnip, mean as an underfed chicken. She was a survivor. She would make this work all alone. She would be better off without the liars and the cheaters and the gamblers to bring her down. She would be just fine.
Chapter 11. She hides it away. The days leading up to the gala were a blur, and Claire couldn't remember which things happened in which order, and in fact, many things happened simultaneously. But each and every detail of these days was charged and important. On Monday, they filled the last table of 10. They had 1,000 guests. Gavin answered the phone and took the credit card for the final table, and it was he who led the celebration, high-fiving Locke and hugging and kissing Isabel, Claire, and Siobhan, all of whom were in the office, ironing out the catering details. Also on Monday, the late summer issue of Nan Mag was released, featuring the article about Nantucket's children and the summer gala. The text of the article was long and preachy about the cause in some places, but no worries. Few people would actually read it. What mattered were the photographs. There was a shot of Locke standing in front of the Elijah Baker house, surrounded by half a dozen children. There was a shot of the chandelier, unwired, taken in Claire's hot shop. There was an old snapshot that Claire had dug up of herself and Matthew in high school. They were in the sand dunes on Wildwood Beach, Matthew holding his guitar, Claire staring moodily at the ocean. There was a photograph of Claire and Locke sitting side by side, though not touching, on the edge of Locke's desk. They were in the office when they looked at the article. Isabel was actually the one who got a hold of the copy of Nan Mag, hot off the press, and all of them skimmed through it together. Locke holding the magazine, while Gavin, Isabel, Claire, and Siobhan read over his shoulder. Locke read certain lines aloud.
"The summer population may believe their beautiful island is immune to the tough realities that face other communities, substandard housing, latchkey kids, petty crime by teenagers, gangs, drug use, but they are wrong. For example, in the winter months, Nantucket has the highest incidence of heroin use per capita in the Commonwealth, and too often, it's the island's children who pay the price."
Claire studied the picture of her and Locke. It was, as far as she knew, the only picture of them ever taken. Did they look like a couple? They did not, she decided. They were completely mismatched. A French film dubbed in Italian. A giraffe with tiger stripes.
Claire was still stinging from the way the catering situation had fallen out. Isabel's words, discouraging and immature, replayed in her mind. Claire didn't have the heart to be tart or snotty with Isabel, however, because Isabel was morose enough as it was. Not one of the people she had personally invited to the gala had deigned to come. She was candid about this, more candid than Claire might have been in the same situation.
"They sent checks," she said, "but they won't come."
Claire thought for a minute or two that Isabel was going to blame the declines on Max West, but it became clear from her near-teary demeanor that she took it personally. They weren't coming because of her, because of whatever had transpired last fall at the Waldorf. Thankfully, Isabel was distracted by the magazine article. Siobhan said to Claire,
"Your hair looks good."
These were the only nice words Siobhan had uttered since coming up to the office. She was exhausted from doing the pops, which had ended very late on Saturday night and took all day Sunday to clean up, and Carter had been no help. He was sick, Siobhan said. Siobhan had agreed to cater the gala, but she did not seem happy about it. She let everyone in the office know that she was not happy, and everyone in the office, including Claire, cowered and deferred to her because she represented their one and only hope. "Thank you," Claire said sweetly, though she disagreed. She thought her hair, which she had tried hard to straighten, made her look like Alfred E. Newman.
"Your hair looks good, too," Gavin said to Locke, and everyone laughed.
Except Isabel. It took Claire a few minutes to notice, but Isabel was silently seething. Finally, she let an audible hiss leak, and she stepped away from the group.
"Nice article," she said flatly. "It really showcases all the work you've done on the event, Claire."
The room fell silent. Claire reeled with surprise. Not that Isabel was offended that she hadn't been photographed or mentioned as co-chair, but that neither she nor Locke, nor Gavin, who had proofread the article weeks ago, had noticed that Isabel had not been photographed or mentioned as co-chair. What Claire thought was, "Oh, shit." What Claire said was, "We all know how much work you've put into this, Isabel. I can't believe there's not more in this article about you."
"There's nothing in the article about me," Isabel spat.
Claire scanned the article. "Surely your name is listed as..."
"It's not," Isabel said. "I've been completely overlooked." "It's a faux pas on Nanmag's part," Gavin said. "We should call them right now and complain. Maybe they'll print a correction in the next issue."
"A correction?" Isabel said. "What good will that do?"
She snatched up her Peter Beaton bag and stormed out. Locke closed the magazine. Gavin, Siobhan, and Claire went to collect their things, but nobody said a word. What to say? Isabel was right. She, the woman who had hired a cellist from the New York Symphony to play at the invitation stuffing, the woman who had wooed Manolo Blahnik into underwriting the event to the tune of $50,000, the woman who had painstakingly made 100 phone calls on the day of the catering crisis, had been overlooked. Would she quit, Claire wondered? Now, in the final hour, would she not show? Locke said,
"Let's give her time to cool down. I'll call her later."
Locke was on the phone with Isabel, in the middle of a long, teary, on Isabel's part, conversation, when Ben Franklin walked into the office. It was nearly 6. Gavin had gone home. Ben stood in front of Locke's desk with the financials clenched in his hands for several minutes as Locke attempted to placate Isabel.
"No one is selling you short. Everyone on the committee understands how hard you've worked, how much of yourself you've poured into this event."
Locke put his hands over the receiver.
"I can't help you now, Ben. I'm trying to talk someone off the ledge here."
Ben's face was stoic. This lack of emotion and the way he was holding forth the financials made him seem like nothing so much as a butler.
"It's important," he croaked. "Eliza was right."
"I'll call you in the morning," Locke said. "First thing."
Ben nodded and, turning on his heels, left the office. On Tuesday, at the office,
The phone wouldn't stop ringing. Everyone wanted gala tickets.
"We're sold out," Gavin said. "I'm sorry. I'll have to put your name on the waiting list."
By noon, the waiting list was 46 people long. What was this? Had everyone read the article in NanMag? Or were people just such procrastinators that they didn't think about Saturday's plans until the Tuesday before? Either way, they were out of luck. Gavin thought this rather smugly. Despite the fact that it wasn't at all his type of music, he was attending the gala as Isabel's guest. He had called her on Monday afternoon to see if she was okay, and she had asked him,
"Will you be my date for the gala?" Isabel had said.
At first he thought she was kidding. He had laughed. She said,
"No, I'm serious."
"Are you sure there isn't someone else who..."
"No,"
Isabel said.
"Absolutely not. I'd like to go with you."
Isabel French, the beautiful, wealthy co-chair of the event, would be attending with Gavin Andrews, handsome, best-looking 1991 Evanston Day, and single, office assistant.
He was on fire. He wished to God that he had known this was going to happen.
If he had known, he would never have...
Locke came back from lunch at 1 o'clock and said, "Damn, I forgot to call Ben Franklin."
Gavin coughed. His throat was blocked.
"Ben Franklin?"
"Ben Franklin," he said.
"Yeah," Locke said. "He took a look at the financials. Nice that he takes an interest now, for the first time ever, when I am insanely busy with other things."
Insanely busy with other things. Yes, Gavin had been so busy answering the phone and taking care of other gala business and thinking of sex with Isabel French that he hadn't even noticed the financial records were missing. Gavin's breathing was shallow. He needed the bathroom.
Jesus, he had to get out of here before he was arrested. Go home, get the duffel bag with the money, and leave. Get to Hyannis at least, then decide where to go. He should have had a better plan. But he had expected to go undetected for a lot longer than this. Ben Franklin took the financials? Unthinkable.
Ben Franklin was completely clueless. Even if he looked at the financials, would he know what was going on? Would he see the cash taken from every deposit? Would he be able to figure it out?
Gavin had to leave.
The less fanfare attending his departure, the better. He should just say he was going to even keel for an iced coffee and never return. But the fact of the matter was, Gavin didn't want to leave. He didn't want to leave this office, which had kept him busy and engaged, and had, for the past few weeks anyway, felt like the center of the universe. The work he was doing fulfilled him. He went home happy. To leave the office now, with the best, most exciting moments to come, with the concert, which Gavin was attending with Isabel French, on the horizon, would be horrible. To leave Nantucket forever would be even worse. And his parents. Just last night, the three of them had had dinner together at the Pearl, and both his parents had remarked on how well he seemed to be doing. Gavin had finally received some much-sought-after approval. Furthermore, it struck Gavin for the first time that his parents were older people. His father now had a hearing aid, and there was no one in the world to care for them but him.
"What have I done?" Gavin thought.
"Stupid, idiotic, moronic, immature, insecure, dishonest, small-minded, short-sighted, and pathetic." That only began to describe the little game he'd been playing since last October. What was money? Money was nothing. What Gavin wanted was esteem. And just as he was starting to get it legitimately, his crimes were catching up with him. How to undo, he wondered. There must be a way.
"I'm going to call Ben right now," Locke said. "Hold my other calls."
Gavin nodded briskly. He had no time to undo. He had to get out of there. But then he heard footsteps on the stairs, and Heather slunk in around the corner, the picture of teenage discontent.
"Dad?" she said.
Locke, who was dialing, hung up the phone.
"Jesus, I forgot."
He jumped up.
Those are what you call whites?
Heather shrugged. She was wearing a pink Lacoste shirt, a pair of almost faded to white denim shorts, and a green grosgrain ribbon belt, and tretorns that had been laced up backwards so that they tied by her toes.
We have a father-daughter tennis match, Locke said to Gavin. Couldn't have come at a worse time.
But we have to play, don't we? You say so, Heather said.
We have to. Greta and Dennis Peel will kill them.
He turned to Gavin.
Are you okay to hold down the fort?
Okay, Gavin said.
Claire was on her way to the rec fields to supervise the construction of the tent. Claire would not be consulted about a single decision, but the gentleman at the town parks and rec department, which owned the fields, wanted a representative from Nantucket's children on hand in case there were any questions. Claire had called Isabel to see if she wanted to do this or to help Claire do this, but Isabel did not answer her phone. She was still pissed about the magazine article. So Claire decided she would go and sit alone in the baking sun while the crew from Tennessee assembled the 40,000-square-foot tent. She sat at a picnic table, drinking diet iced tea, playing solitaire. She tried to make the cards say something. Stay with Locke or leave him. Continue to pray for strength or just exhibit it. Reclaim her life. Work on her marriage. She loved Locke and she hated him. The worst things about adultery, it seemed, were countless. At noon, when the crew broke for lunch, she left. On the way home, she stopped by Siobhan's commercial kitchen to see if she could help somehow. She couldn't construct a tent, but with direction, she could whip up a batch of curried mango chutney. Claire walked into the kitchen without knocking. Why would she knock? She expected a kitchen full of people. Siobhan, Carter, Alec, Floyd, Raimundo, Vaslav. It was, after all, the middle of August, and Island Fair had a Herculean task ahead of them. By not knocking, however, Claire interrupted something. She blew into the kitchen, which had all of the fans running, possibly masking the noise of her entrance, and caught Siobhan and Edward by surprise. Edward Melior? It just wasn't possible. But yes, he and Siobhan were at the long stainless steel counter, standing very close to each other. Siobhan saw Claire first and jumped and pushed Edward away, or so it seemed, and Edward whipped around and saw Claire. And whereas his face registered guilt, it also registered relief. Claire was not Carter. Hi, Claire said brightly and casually, as though there were nothing about finding Edward Melior in Siobhan's prep kitchen that shocked her. On the counter were the makings for the crispy pork wontons. Claire pointed to the stack of wonton wrappers and said, Yum, my favorite. Siobhan said, What are you doing here? And Edward said, Hey, Claire, how's it going with the tent? Claire plucked a water chestnut out of a 5-pound can and ate it. Tent's going up, she said. What was going on here, exactly? Siobhan could not abide having Edward's name mentioned in conversation, and yet here they were, alone, together. Claire had wondered if something had happened between the two of them at the invitation stuffing at Isabel's house. They had both stepped away from the table for a long time. But when Claire had asked, How was it with Edward the other night? Siobhan had shrugged and said, Laborious, as usual. Claire was bowled over by Edward's presence here. And where was Carter? Was she missing something? What are you doing here, Edward? She asked. Oh, Edward said. He smiled. He had a smile for every occasion, and this one was his pretending to be innocent smile. I was just helping Siobhan fill the wontons. Really? Claire said. This was the Edward who would eat peanut butter on a roof shingle and who couldn't tell white burgundy from lighter fluid? She's in the weeds, Edward said. And who wouldn't be? She is saving our asses, taking the gala on at the last minute. Indeed she is, Claire said. She glanced at Siobhan to see how she liked being talked about in the third person. Siobhan's mouth was a tight little pucker, and her freckled nose twitched like a rabbit's.
I came for that very same reason, to see if I could help. Can I help?
I'm fine, Siobhan said. I think I'll just finish up here myself.
Yes, Edward said. I have a showing at 1 anyway.
Are you sure you don't want any help? Claire said. I'm sure.
Edward jingled change in his pocket.
I may just stay and help Siobhan finish this.
I thought you had a showing at 1, Claire said.
I do. You should go, Siobhan said.
Don't you want me to stay? Edward asked.
There was an uncomfortable pause. Go, Siobhan said. Both of you.
On Wednesday, Gavin went to work, against his better judgment. It was a gamble, one that was almost as quickening as the act of stealing the money in the first place. Had Locke spoken to Ben Franklin? Would the office be stormed by federal agents? Would Gavin be led away in handcuffs? These were real possibilities, he knew, but Gavin's gut instinct was that he would be safe for at least one more day, and he hoped this was all he would need to figure things out. He had been up all night, thinking it through, and he had arrived at a shocking conclusion. He didn't want to leave Nantucket. He didn't want to flee to Southeast Asia or anywhere else. And so he had to figure out a way to put the money back, to unsteal it. This was harder than it might seem. He had pilfered the money over the course of 100 transactions. He couldn't just deposit the lump sum now. The duffel bag, which contained $52,000, was in the back seat of his Mini Cooper, which was parked, locked up tight, on Union Street. What Gavin needed was for Ben Franklin to back off. Once the gala was behind them and all the summer people went home, Gavin would find a way to quietly square the books, but he couldn't do it now with everyone breathing down his neck. Locke strolled in at 9:05. He looked at Gavin and grinned.
We won at tennis, he said.
And Gavin, who had decided in the wee hours that the most important thing was not to call any attention to his plight, threw this resolution out the window immediately.
Did you ever catch up with Ben Franklin? He asked.
No, Locke said. To be honest with you, I don't have time to deal with him right now.
I hear you, Gavin said. He's not quite right upstairs anymore anyway. You know that, don't you?
I do know it, Locke said. I'll advise Adams to find a new treasurer in the fall, but nobody will want to do it.
Nobody, Gavin echoed.
The phone rang.
Time to get to work, Locke said.
On Wednesday, Ted Trimble called to say that the chandelier was wired.
Do you want to come get it? He asked Claire.
Yes, she said. From the car, Claire called Locke at the office. Things had been stilted and businesslike between them since the catering fiasco, but if anyone should go with her to get the chandelier, it was Locke, and so she asked, would he go with her to Ted Trimble's shop and pick up the chandelier? Would he help her deliver it to the rec fields? They would store it in the concession stand.